en colloque. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Academy. On retrouve Élodie Courtejoie.
Bonjour, c'est une certitude, depuis le début de l'année 2007, la planète connaît des épisodes climatiques extrêmes. En janvier et avril, les températures de surface sur Terre ont été respectivement plus chaudes de 1,89 et de 1,37 par rapport aux moyennes enregistrées depuis 1880. Aucun continent n'a été épargné par les cataclysmes. En Europe, l'Angleterre et le Pays de Galles ont reçu, de mai à juillet 2007, la quantité de précipitations la plus élevée depuis 1766. Elles ont occasionné des crues et des inondations historiques en Angleterre. En Asie, à Oman, les habitants ont vu le premier cyclone de leur histoire. Une vague de chaleur a frappé l'Inde au milieu du mois de mai avec des températures atteignant 45 voire 50 degrés. En Afrique, le Mozambique a été frappé en février 2007 par des inondations provoquant la mort de 30 personnes et l'évacuation de 120 000 autres. Et parallèlement, on pouvait skier en Afrique du Sud avec les 25 cm de neige fraîchement tombée. Enfin, en Amérique latine, l'ouragan Dean, en août et septembre 2007, a provoqué sur son passage la mort d'une trentaine de personnes dans les Caraïbes et au Mexique. L'Uruguay a connu début mai ses pires inondations depuis 1959, alors que début juillet, une vague de froid a entraîné des chutes de neige importantes dans le sud de l'Amérique latine et des températures extrêmement basses, moins 22 degrés en Argentine et moins 18 degrés au Chili, et c'était donc en juillet. Comment prévenir efficacement ces événements climatiques tels que les inondations, les ouragans, les tempêtes, les crues? Des chercheurs français et étrangers se sont réunis en juillet 2007 à la Fondation Simone et Cino del Duca, fondation de l'Institut de France, lors d'un colloque de plusieurs jours pour faire le point sur les événements climatiques extrêmes et leurs conséquences environnementales, économiques et sociales. Nous vous proposons d'écouter une grande partie de ces interventions, à la fois en anglais et en français, retransmises au cours de 5 émissions en colloque sur Canal Academy. Dans cette première partie, les orateurs tirent parti du passé pour évaluer l'influence du changement climatique sur l'accroissement de la population mondiale, prévue à l'horizon 2050. Vous allez pouvoir écouter dans quelques instants Denis Coeur et Michel Lang, ainsi que Christian Gaulier. Mais tout de suite, débutons par la communication d'Henri Le Ridon de l'Institut National d'Études Démographiques, l'INED. Il développe pour nous la relation entre population humaine et climat dans l'histoire. Elle se poursuit par l'intervention de l'anglais Evan Fraser de l'Institut de Recherche sur le Développement Durable. Son intervention est consacrée, quant à elle, à l'utilisation de la variabilité climatique du passé pour comprendre la résilience des systèmes d'alimentation aux changements climatiques à venir. Ces deux communications sont en anglais.
What I'm going to speak about briefly is to try to give you some sense of what demographers think about the past history of population, of the world population. And we will see that by and large, the population, the human species, has resisted rather well. That's why we are here to speak today, to talk today. That the growth of the world population has been almost continuous, not exactly, but we will see that seen from a far distance, it is a rather continuous growth. But there were mechanisms to make up, to recover from specific events or bad periods in the past. But we must also be aware of the fact that the climate is not maybe the most important factor in these fluctuations and changes in trends. Then we will turn to the future, which is not easier than to look at the past. The demographic forecast assumes that it is likely that the world population will stabilize probably at the end of this century. Obviously, there are uncertainties in these projections. The components are fertility, mortality, migration. On fertility, it depends on behavior. And indeed, it is quite a difficult issue. On mortality, we know in a way more, and it is easier to make forecasts, except that in case of dramatic events, things may change and may change rapidly, and this is quite difficult to forecast. And for migration, if we look at the global level, it is zero. But if we look at more detailed levels and national levels, for instance, then forecasts are also difficult to say, to state. And then we'll briefly see what are the possible effects of climate on these trends. So let us go first quickly through the history of the population. I'm not an archaeologist, but I've put here some dates. The Homo habilis appeared probably about 1 million years ago. And then it was followed by the Pithecanthrope about 700,000 years ago. We will see more important changes in the next steps. The Homo sapiens and with various branches in Europe, in Asia and elsewhere appeared about 100,000 years ago. In Europe, the major step was the Homo sapiens sapiens and maybe a bit before the Cro-Magnon, about 30,000 or 40,000 years ago. So here we are, Homo sapiens sapiens, supposedly. One key period, and we will see that in a graph in a minute, was the Neolithic period. For demographic growth, it is something quite important. So it goes back to about 10 or 6,000 years ago. Why is it so important? It is because at the time when population started to sedentarize, when agriculture really started to appear, urbanization also, the trade and services. And it was also the time where the man was able to make the first impacts on climate, on environment. I will show you a graph that has been bravely designed by a demographer and historian called Jean-Noël Birabin, who is, by the way, also a specialist of the history of plague. And he was the first to suggest to draw these curves. I'm sure that you cannot see really what is on the graph from where you stand. So I will briefly describe it. It starts from 60,000 years from now, 65,000 years from now. So that's on the back, on the left of the graph. Where is mouse? Oh yes, here it is. And it goes to the present time. So this is the world population that is drawn here. And you see that it was supposed to be less than 1 million... less than 1 million up to about 40,000 years ago. Then there was a change of the Paleolithic period with new tools, which probably improve the situation for the world population. Then, after this growth, setting the population to about 4-5 million, there was again a period of stabilization, and it is only at the Neolithic period, the last part of this graph, the Neolithic period, that the growth started again and almost without any stop until now. So during the Neolithic period, probably this population went from 6-7 million up to 100 million. That was an enormous growth in the context of these times. So this is the steps. And the last period, obviously, is on the extreme right of the graph, where it's almost vertical with the scale. This is a logarithmic scale, by the way. However, it is almost vertical. This is the demographic explosion, as we say sometimes, started only during the 20th century. And if you have very good eyes, maybe you can see that at the very end of the curve, there is a change in direction. And that's what we assume that's going to happen at the end of this century with a stop in the growth and maybe even a decrease in the world population. How can we draw such a graph? As you know, the sources are not very numerous. The really quantitative data on population go back no further than the 17th or 18th century to have good data. You can go some more centuries back by using some censuses or limited countings that were done here and there. Going even back more in the back, you can find some written evidence in texts that were published since about 2,000 years. That's the case for the Roman period, for instance, also for China. And if you go even more back, then you have to turn to archaeology. And then you combine the fact that we have some evidence of the presence of the human population in a place, in some region. You combine that with an estimate of the possible density of the population, knowing the kind of tools that were used at that time. And this is derived from contemporary or almost contemporary populations living approximately in the same conditions. One special feature on this graph is that there are also fluctuations. Obviously, this is not a result of detailed information on each of these periods, but it suggests that there were fluctuations, that's pretty obvious, and it gives you some kind of order of magnitude of these fluctuations. So that's to say that apparently, and that's why I say that the growth of the population was almost continuous, we have no evidence of a period where the population would have decreased a lot during the past history. Locally, obviously, there were such crises. But overall, at the world level, there were some periods of reduction, but rather limited compared to the major period of growth at the Paleolithic and at the Neolithic, mainly. Well, that's what I was just saying. There were climatic sources to these variations, obviously. We know, for instance, we have the records of these ice periods in Europe and elsewhere in the past. This was also accompanied by major changes, for instance, in the level of the sea, more than 100 meters, for instance, more higher since the last ice period. So this is just to say that we have evidence of adverse events and adverse periods for the human growth, and however, it survived and even continued to grow over these periods. Why was it so? Probably because there has been always some kinds of mechanism of self-regulating mechanism which were operating. I will give you just an evidence because this one was well described for a recent period. It's only for the historical France, 17th, 18th century. Nuptiality was there to play a major role. Why? Because in France and other European countries, marriage was occurring on average late. Late means at the age of 25, 26 for women and a bit more for men. And this was due to the fact that to get married, you had to be able to settle somewhere. So to get a place, a land to work on, whatever the system that was in place, you had to work somewhere. And so it was depending on the availability of such lands and of such tenures. And when a mortality crisis was occurring, then this was freeing immediately a number of lands, of tenures, and this was an opportunity for younger adults to get independent and to marry because it was a precondition. So the fact that they were marrying younger at that time was also meaning that they were starting to have children earlier in their life and ending with more children than previous generations. So that's why, at the end, the loss in the population due to mortality, to the excess of mortality, was made up by this increase in nuptiality and fertility in the subsequent years. This works up to some point, obviously, but it is not trivial because it has been estimated that an excess of 50% deaths during 1 year, which is not nothing, could have been compensated by this mechanism. As you may know, the Black Death in the 14th century could kill about 30-40% of a population in a specific region. So it's the order of magnitude of this kind of event. To show you that it was not a rare event, you have here a statistic of mortality crisis that was built for Italy. It goes from 1570 approximately to 1840. And this is the frequency of crisis by a period. The peaks of this curve means that the periodicity was about one crisis every 10 years, for instance, in the middle of the 17th century. So during a generation, during the life of an individual, he was exposed to more than one crisis, important crisis. In that case, on this graph, this is crisis where mortality was in excess by 50% or more above the normal level. So that's major crisis. And in the next graph, we see even more important crisis with an excess of deaths by 100%, doubling of the number of deaths, of the annual number of deaths. And again, at least up to the 17th century, these events were not rare and in the life of individuals. There are situations, however, where a catastrophic event cannot be compensated. Here you have a mathematical analysis that was done by Hervé Le Bras some decades ago. There were several sets of simulations. In what I will show you, it was supposed that mortality was striking at some ages, preferably, with a maximum about the age of 30, young adults. And in that case, it was assumed that 75% of the generation of that ages were killed by some specific event. And in another example, we will see what happened if we assume that the young people, the young children that are more often dying in the simulation. He used two very different populations with different rate of growth and different age structure to see whether that was making differences. So the two populations were ancient France and a contemporary population from Africa, Dahomey, I don't know exactly why. We start from a situation where it was assumed that the number of births was about 1 million per year, say, whatever period it is. And we can see that after this catastrophe, the population, the number of births, but finally the size of the population itself, was approximately divided by half and stabilized at half the initial level. There were fluctuations, more important in the case of France, due to the initial age structure, but finally the consequence was the same in both populations. So in that case, there was no mechanism to recover, and the impact of this exceptional mortality crisis was quite visible forever. This is the second assumption, where it was assumed that only young people were dying during the crisis, and the final situation is not much different from the previous one. There have been a number of more complex models developed, and I'm not going to review that now. Let us just look at the more simple of these models. The idea is to find some kind of link between the rate of growth of a population and usually density. And if you look at density, it means that in fact you look at the size of the population. So it is, in a way, a purely endogenous model linking the size of the population to the rate of growth of the population. But in practice, in most cases, you add some kind of mediating factor, which is often, for historical analysis, the cost of cereals, which was a key determinant for food and for finally the health and the mortality of the population in the past. And indeed, we find, as far as it is possible to prove, to give proofs of this kind of things, we find a negative correlation between the level of fertility, and the level of fertility is what finally is the main determinant of the rate of growth, and density. So a negative correlation between fertility and density. And we can even try to quantify a bit this relation. And we can, that's not what I see now. Another point is that in the case of a sudden reduction in the size of the population by 20%, then this mechanism will allow some kind of recuperation, but only after 70 years on average. One interesting point also is to see that, to show that even under this kind of homeostatic assumption, a population can have random fluctuations. And in that case, this can be analyzed through the random walk theory developed by Feller. And you can see, which is one of the results of this theory, that even if the fluctuations were at random, then at one point of time, the population can depart from the trend and permanently. And this is just an example to show you that. It is a simulation, a stochastic simulation of a population. Under the homeostatic assumption, we can see that there are fluctuations. Under another model, which is not homeostatic, we can see that in that case, the population can depart from the trend permanently. I can give you detailed information on that with a few minutes that I have. There has been also some attempts to link these fluctuations or these trends to climate. Again, usually the climate effect goes through the production of cereals, in fact. And the main work was done by Galloway in the 80s, and he was able to show a positive correlation between periods with rather warm winters and the rate of growth. And the correlation was negative in case of too warm summers compared to normal, and the rate of growth. The correlation in that case was quantified in a very precise way, in a way, as an average, I think that was done by Ronald Lee, in fact, the author of the previous result I have shown. 1 degree more in winter could lead to 1.1% of change in demographic growth. That's not a lot, 0.1%. But you must remember that in the past, it was approximately the average level of growth of the human populations. The maximum was reached in the 1960s with 2% for the world population. That was the maximum ever in the world population. So 0.1% in the long term, that makes really a difference. I'm sorry, I'm taking too much. How much time do I have now? 10 minutes. 10 minutes, okay. Just to end with this part, I must remind you also that, especially for demographers, climate is probably not the key variable, at least was not in the past. Epidemics were there, and we know that they were devastating I've already mentioned the plague, especially in Europe. It started in 1348. It is very well documented, and it can be assumed that 1/3 or more of population, even of the whole population of England, for instance, after several epidemics, disappeared. The cholera was there, even in France in the middle of the 19th century. There were three periods with a total deaths of 400,000 overall, which is not trivial. You also know that after the World War of 1914 or 1918, there was a Spanish influenza in Europe. In France, it meant one more year. It was equivalent to one more year of war. The number of persons dying was equivalent to the death toll of last year, 1917, of the war. The wars themselves, obviously, are sources of excess of mortalities, unfortunately, quite often. Again, to give you an idea, in France, the number of people killed during the war, the excess of mortality, was equivalent to two generations. It was as if two generations disappeared totally. And in addition, there were a deficit in birth, which was also equivalent to two generations, as if women had no children during 2 years. Famines also are quite frequent, and the list is unfortunately very long. Again, to show you that there might be very strange events, in the sense that the causes are not obvious and could have been avoided at least, certainly the case of China during the Great Leap forwards in 1959-61, the toll of deaths and the deficit of births was exactly equivalent to the case of the First World War for France at the scale of China. I mean, the proportions were exactly the same, without civil war, without external war, without, as far as we know, epidemic, probably some problem with climate and bad crops. And certainly there has been in the past very often a mix of these various events. So now, briefly, what can we say about tomorrow? The projections are made by United Nations mainly, but also by the World Bank. There have been also an attempt by the IASA in Vienna recently. By and large, they are quite coherent. And for instance, on this graph, I put the last projection of the United Nations, that's the lower curve. And the projection of the World Bank done about 5-6 years previously, which is probably the reason why it is a bit higher than the United Nations. The United Nations revised the projections progressively, and the IASA projection is somewhere in between. The difference at the end of our century now, of the current century, would be about 1 billion people. That's mean 10% uncertainty, which in a way is not much. On this graph, we can see how the United Nations have revised their forecast, their projections in the past. So the scale is a bit strange. It's a year where the projection was done. And each line gives you the projection for one specific year. So the lower ones, the red one, was for 1980. So obviously now we know what was the population in 1980. So what we can see is that the very first projections were done in the 1940s, and they were revised upwards and stabilized to the actual number of the population, the actual size of the population after 1980. But for the year 2000, and the first time this year was projected was in 1957, you can see that we are still at the same level as the one estimated in 1957. Almost no change. For year 2025, we can say the same, that the third curve. And for long-term projections, you can see 2050 here, 2100 here, and even 150 here. You can see that they've been revised downwards in the 70s and 80s. So there is no explosion in the projections. That's even going the other way. The explosion is still visible here. If you look at least at one very unplausible assumption, which is assuming that fertility would not change. And if you start from now, from the 6-7 billion people living on Earth today, then if you assume that fertility is not going to change at all, there will be really an explosion. This is a very unrealistic assumption. And you see that the medium assumption of the United Nations assume a stabilization at about 10 billion. We have low and high assumptions. And in the past, we can see that the truth has always been between these assumptions and even the low medium or high medium assumption, as they call them, which still gives you some uncertainty for the future, but rather limited. The problem with demographic projection is that for fertility, you have a cumulative effect. If you project the population up to 15, 20 years from now, the birth that will occur during this period of time will contribute to the size of the population, but just to the size of the population itself. But after 20 years, these people will have children. So you have to make an assumption about the number of children this new generation will have. And after 50 years, another generation will have also children. So when you reach a duration of about 100 years, the population will have been totally renewed. Almost nobody will survive from the initial population. And you will have made assumptions on fertility concerning three generations at all. So you have to say, how many children the children of your children will have, which is not an easy guess. For mortality, since now the level of mortality is low up to the age of 50, even 70 years, so the impact of your assumptions will mainly concern the higher ages, which means that the effect on the total population will be rather limited. For migration, it is certainly difficult to say what will be in the future. We even don't know for one country for the next years. But we can see that it is for one country very often below 1.5% per year, plus or minus, it depends. If you look at the projection done recently by the United Nations also for migration, it is extreme situations where you have at the national level more than 1.5 or 1.6% of change a year, and usually it's not assumed that it is going to last very long. In any case, it's true that it is difficult to make provision for that. In these projections, dramatic events, catastrophic events are rarely taken into account because they are difficult to forecast. In the EASA simulation, because there was some kind of modelization allowing for taking into account a case of excess in mortality, an example was taken. If you assume that in a sub-Saharan country, mortality is increased by 20%, then it can be shown that the size of the population will be maintained after 10 or 15 years, 10 or 15 years after the crisis. So the shock is not going to be visible in the long range. A kind of climatic catastrophic event has been lived in our country, as you know, in 4 years ago, during the heat wave. Again, it depends on the kind of lens you use. If you look day by day, then the number of deaths in France was multiplied by 2.5 during 3 days in August. The effect on the month of August was an excess of mortality by 36%. And on the year, it was 3%. 3% is a fluctuation which is visible on the curve, but still it is only, if I may say, 3%. And in that case, we must remember that more than 80% of the people who died for this reason were over 75 years. And also that there was some kind of mechanism operating there, because a very surprising result is that the expectancy of life in France not only has been recovering after this period of time, but has been increased. If you look at the trend in the expectancy of life, there is a discontinuity in the year 2003, and there was a gain of some months, probably due to the fact that after this dramatic event, we looked more carefully to the situation of the aged people and were more prepared to new events, and even able to help them and probably increase a bit their expectancy of life. So the long-term effect of this event in France will be positive in terms of mortality, which is a surprise. Finally, just to leave you with some key figures, we are today in Earth about 6,007,000. The projection, as I said, will be about less than 10 billion, probably in the higher assumption, it is 10.8 billion in 2050. The medium assumption is 9.2 billion for the population, not far from the final number, which is assumed to be about 10 billion. Thank you.
Hello, and thank you very much, everyone. I'm very sorry not to be able to speak in French. It has been many years since I was in high school, which was the last opportunity I had to speak French and practice French. And there's very little opportunity to use the language in Northern England, especially the rural part of Northern England that I now call home. At any rate, as the nice introduction just said, my name is Evan Fraser, and I'm coming to you from the University of Leeds in the Northern United Kingdom. And the title which I've chosen for myself today is a slight amendment from the title that is published in your proceedings. And what I'm interested in is the vulnerability of food systems to climate change and extracting lessons from the past, focusing on the question of adaptability. And the logic behind my talk is quite simple, I think. As we look forward to a future that many people suspect will be full of climactic surprises, it's helpful to look back, as we just learned in the last talk, and remember that the climate has often surprised us. And most of the time, we have been quite successful at adapting to the climate variability of the past. And this leads us to make some conclusions that climate is not a good predictor of things like mortality, food security. But sometimes the climate change, environmental variability, has caused us enormous problems. And a very important example of this comes from the ancient city of Tikal in modern-day Mexico, the Yucatan Peninsula. And this photograph here is taken from one of these dramatic roof combs over the jungle of what used to be a bustling home to 60, 70,000 people, perhaps. And although we'll never know for sure why this community was abandoned, the archaeologists, the experts in the civilization, figure that drought had a major role in causing this city and the cities of this region to be abandoned at roughly the same period of time, somewhere around the year 1000 AD. Another dramatic example from a different part of the world is this, the Viking communities in Greenland. And about 1300, 1400 years AD, the community established itself, set up vibrant, reasonably prosperous farms, and then during a period of cooling, the icebergs reinvaded the North Atlantic. These farms no longer were viable, and this culture found itself unable to adapt. So armed with these sort of very dramatic instances. The research question that I set for myself is, what can we learn from past events to help us identify where we are vulnerable today? And then as we look forward to a future that we think will be full of climactic surprises, maybe we can take some of that information and some of those lessons to identify future vulnerability. Now, before I start getting into some of my case studies, I thought it might be useful to outline a little bit of the academic background, some of the intellectual tools which I've found useful in constructing these things, and especially as I look out to a fairly interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary audience, a little bit of academic background is often quite useful. So if you sat yourself down at an academic search engine and started typing in the words climate variability, vulnerability and food or food productivity, and my comments here are entirely focused on the issue of food and food production, you would identify a quantitative tradition running right through the last 15, 20 years of research on the subject. And initially, the initial attempts were to develop impact models, where we took our understanding of how different crops grow under different temperature and moisture regimes, and essentially looked at a map of where those crops are grown, looked at what the future climate would be like in those regions, and tried to assess whether or not yields would go up or yields would go down. So this was a fairly technologically sophisticated, but in some ways quite simple approach of linking crop yields and climate predictions to assess impact. Now, the problem with this approach is that it doesn't allow farmers to adapt. It assumes that a region that currently grows corn will continue to grow corn and that the farmers won't change their cropping patterns. So this led to a second generation of models that assume farmers will plant the crops most suited to the new climate conditions. And so to assess impact, you take your future climate conditions and you match them with the best possible crops for those climate conditions. And the problem with these models is that they assume that farmers will perfectly or seamlessly adapt to new climate conditions, ignoring land tenure, market incentives, policies, whatever other possible endogenous or exogenous effects may inhibit adaptation. So now the current literature seems to sit with a bunch of models or a modeling approach that makes a range of impact assessments using different socioeconomic and climatological scenarios. And as a quick illustration, here's a figure from Dagmar Schroeder's and company's paper called Ecosystem Service Supply and Vulnerability to Global Change in Europe. And what the four maps of Europe illustrate are four different socioeconomic and climate futures. And the colors illustrate what's going to happen to farmland productivity under those four different scenarios, with the dark green indicating a decline in climate agricultural productivity, and the yellow indicating slight increases. And while this is illustrating, is depending on what sort of climate scenarios you use and what sort of socioeconomic assumptions you make, you're going to have very, very different possible effects. Alongside, and in some ways converging with this modeling tradition, is a qualitative tradition based on food security that refers directly to Amartya Sen's work that was just referred to. And really, Amartya Sen's work in the early 80s starts, in my opinion, or provides a useful reference point for this approach. And the focus here is on the ways that people obtain food. Where the climate modelers are more interested in how food is produced, the focus in the qualitative tradition is much more on demand and the way of obtaining food. Department for International Development in the United Kingdom formalized this sort of approach in what they call the Sustainable Livelihoods Approach. And essentially, the Sustainable Livelihoods Approach looks at how different types of capital, this is social capital that a person's networks might be, their human capital, the sort of skills and education and level of health they have, their financial capital, which is the sort of normal use of the word capital, looks at how people use these different kinds of assets to obtain food under different circumstances, and specifically looks at how people use different types of assets, different types of capital, to overcome problems like drought, floods, and whatnot. And this sustainable livelihoods approach has resulted in a large number of very sophisticated, culturally nuanced case studies from around the world, specifically Africa and Southern Asia, but mostly Africa, that try to understand how people use their social networks, their family ties, their arrangements with sources of industry to overcome problems like drought. Most recently, There has been attempts to generalize all of these field studies and link them with global forces. The sustainable livelihoods approach is criticized because it provides snapshots in time that are very, very qualitative. And then the question becomes, well, what use are those as we look forward into the future? And so what I'm arguing here is that there's an attempt by some of these sustainable livelihoods people to generalize their approach. And what I've got here is a slow build on an attempt at doing this by Bill Turner, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And what I'm about to show you is his framework for vulnerability analysis in the sustainability science. And Bill Turner's framework says, well, we have to take the local case studies that come out of this livelihoods approach, and they sort of define the human conditions and how the human interacts with the environment. And that then leads to an understanding of coping responses and whatnot that are rooted in the community. And then, and I don't want you to get distracted by the boxes on this next part of the graph, these are then linked into regional effects in the yellow and global effects in the green. This is an extremely complicated approach. I don't think it's very usable. It represents a first step, and the authors of this paper are very much at pains to describe that this is not a predictive model. This is a heuristic or conceptual framework to help organize our thinking. But what they're trying to do, aside from the fact that they've given us an hopelessly complicated flowchart, is what they're trying to do is really quite important, which is to generalize from the individual case studies that the livelihoods approach has given us, and to try to link that insight into global forces. So what I'm trying to argue with these different examples is that there's these two approaches, the quantitative on one side that's modeling, and the qualitative on the other side that's based on livelihoods and capitals. And I think they're converging. And I think that one of the most interesting places to find this convergence is within the field of resilience theory, specifically work done by landscape ecologists under what's called the Panarchy Banner. It's a somewhat peculiar word. And the Panarchy Banner is the Panarchy scholars essentially are landscape ecologists who have looked at how ecosystems that seem stable over long periods of time suddenly collapse. In other words, they look at why this, a cigarette butt dropped in a forest, 99 times out of 100, or maybe 999 times out of 1,000, simply goes out. And that other time, it turns into this, a catastrophic raging forest fire that causes the ecosystem to collapse. And by studying ecosystems that seem stable over long periods and then suddenly collapse, the people, such as Lance Gunderson and Buzz Halling, who wrote the book The Panarchy Theory, argue that there are three general characteristics of vulnerability in ecosystems. The first is the diversity in the ecosystem. Low diversity systems, systems where there's a small number of species that dominate, are more vulnerable than high diversity systems because the same problem may affect a large proportion of a low diversity ecosystem. The amount of connectivity in the ecosystem is also important. Ecosystems that are very tightly packed, a forest with a lot of trees per hectare, is more vulnerable than a loosely connected forest because a problem may jump easily from individual to individual. Finally, the amount of biomass is important, biomass that could provide fuel for a fire or fodder for a pest. And these scholars, these landscape ecologists, argue that if you see an ecosystem over time lose diversity, gain biomass, or gain in connectivity, in other words, moving to the top right backhand corner of this vulnerability space, then you're seeing an ecosystem where smaller and smaller problems may cause bigger and bigger impacts. Now, in my opinion, this is a wonderful model. It provides a nice, clear visual framework. It's very explicit about the variables. It's quite simple to understand. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for human systems very well. Diversity, biomass, and connectivity are not particularly good predictors for human systems. And so there's been attempts to try to make this work for human systems, but for reasons we can discuss in coffee, I'm not convinced that they work very well. So I've provided you with three intellectual tools. The first is a quantitative modeling tradition, which is strength is its predictive power, but it struggles to capture locally relevant factors that influence adaptation. The second is the qualitative livelihoods tradition that tries to capture adaptation through local context by looking at how people use different types of assets. But it's very unclear to me how to generalize or quantify this sort of approach. And finally, the landscape ecology tradition is explicit about environmental variables and provides an understanding of changes through time, provides a nice clear visual framework, but it doesn't really work for human systems very well. And so, based on this assessment of the literature, my own research aim is to contrast cases where relatively small problems, defined climatologically, had large impacts on food production. So essentially what I've been trying to do, and my colleagues for the last 5 years, is to take the same approach those landscape ecologists did, to look at cases that seem food systems, that seem relatively stable over time, and then rapidly collapse, to see if we can distill general characteristics. So how we organized our research was according to this sort of design. When you read about the vulnerability literature, there's three key concepts that I think keep coming up. The first is exposure. And the first thing we have to understand is how big a problem are you likely to face or have you faced? Is it a small drought or is it a very serious drought? The second key concept is adaptability. Will you be able to adapt to this problem? And under the heading of adaptability, a tremendous amount has been written that focuses on both socioeconomic and biophysical characteristics. And finally, the impact of the problem is clearly a key concept. And the references for this are the IPCC's Working Group 2's reports and that draw heavily on the spaces of vulnerability, a seminal paper from Progress in Human Geography. I think these three concepts can easily be displayed in the following design. If you can imagine the exposure to a problem heuristically displayed as the x-axis or the independent variable, the impact of the problem displayed heuristically again as the y-axis or the dependent variable. And to make it a little more sophisticated, we can imagine sort of a nested hierarchy of impacts that start with harvest impacts leading to economic and then health. And then on this sort of framework, we can imagine plotting discrete or individual events, environmental change events such as droughts. And having done this using a range of data for a range of cases, you often see a relationship where the worse the problem is in the past, the worse the impact is. But you always see situations like this one, where a small problem seemed to be matched with a big impact. And this leads to the hypothesis, did the people that were in this situation just fail to adapt? Similarly, there's the converse situation where big problems were matched with small impacts. And I think we can define vulnerability this way, essentially that... And in this way, we've got exposure, adaptability, and impact all contained relatively simply. And we can define vulnerability sort of as to where in this sort of space a place falls in through a past analysis, where if you see a situation where exposure to a small problem seemed to result in a big impact, well, that's a pretty good indication that things are vulnerable. And then the question becomes, what's different about the vulnerable to the resilient? So let me give you a few case studies that I think illustrate some of this. The first one is the Irish potato famine of 1845 to 1850. Here's a plate from a London newspaper at the time showing a famine victim. And I would say Ireland in 1845 was very, very vulnerable in the way I just defined it. The problem that it faced was relatively small and commonplace, but its impact was huge. Bit more specifically, in 1845, a raining year created ideal conditions for a fungal blight to destroy Ireland's potato crop. A million people died and a million people emigrated, and this represented about a quarter of the population. Interestingly, blights had struck earlier in Irish history, and the potato crop had failed with regularity in the early 19th century. The blight is also the most significant pest affecting potato crops worldwide. This leads to the question, what was so different about Ireland in 1845 that made it so vulnerable? I'll come back to the answer shortly. Case number two is the late Victorian famines. This was the period of time when the British Empire was at its peak, the Raj in India was at its most opulent, while outside of the palaces of the Raj were scenes of the most horrific deprivation. More specifically, between 1875 and 1902, El Niño-induced droughts killed an upwards of 45 million people in the monsoon region. Historically, droughts in this region are common. Famine, at least famine on this kind of scale, are not common. I believe this is unprecedented. So the question then becomes, why was this region so vulnerable in the late 19th century that a relatively predictable environmental perturbation caused such mass deprivation? The third case study is Ethiopia between 1960 and 1997. And here we have the ability to be a little more quantitative. The Center for the research on the epidemiology of disasters has kept track of droughts across the world and has identified the following droughts in Ethiopia, most of which happened in the north of the country. And I draw your attention to the 1973, 74, and 84 droughts, where the death toll is measured in the hundreds of thousands. In this case, I was able to get, or myself and my colleagues were able to get rainfall and crop data for the areas affected by the droughts, and were able to sort of start calculating things like exposure and impact in a slightly more quantitative way. So we were able to collect rainfall data to develop some rainfall indexes, where on the graph I'm about to show you, a high number indicates abundant rainfall, and a low number indicates quite a bad drought. And a crop index, similarly, where a high number indicates abundant crop, and a low number indicates not very much crop. And when we plotted these droughts in this way, we observed absolutely no relationship between the severity of the drought, measured crudely using rainfall data. I'm not standing by the rigorousness of that definition of drought, but there was absolutely no relationship we could find whatsoever. We did, however, see cases like this one versus cases like this one, where good harvests, in the green case, good harvests were matched with poor rainfall, suggesting maybe there was adaptability going on. And poor harvests were matched with abundant rainfall in the red case, suggesting perhaps people failed to adapt. And then the question becomes, what was different about those cases? And so what we played with this data a little bit and sort of divided X by Y axes and developed some ratios of impact to exposure just to see if we could come up with some trends. And eventually we came up with an index in this way that we plotted over time, which suggests that the middle period of time between 1960 and 1997 seemed to be the most sensitive to drought, to perturbations in rainfall. So then the question then becomes, what was different about Ethiopia at the middle period of this data, of this time series, that made it so vulnerable? Just like we were asking the question, what was so vulnerable Ireland in the 1845 and the Victorian the British colonies in the 1870s and 80s, what was vulnerable about Ethiopia in the middle of this data set? My final case study is Eastern China between 1960 and the year 2000. And here I've been looking with some Chinese colleagues, again at production data and rainfall data, for the provinces to the east of this red line. This is the sort of the important grain-producing region in China. And there's no famine that's taken place over this period of time here. So this case study is a little different than the first three I've introduced to you. But this is a highly important grain-producing region, and so a number of Chinese colleagues and I thought it would be interesting to see if we could start looking at sensitivity to changes in rainfall in the same way. So the first thing we did was we looked for each province and each year. We looked at how much rainfall had fallen in the growing season and measured that in standard deviations. And then we looked at how much harvest people had got in each province, in each year, and unsurprisingly found that in years with high rainfall, very, very high rainfall and very, very low rainfall, the crops were lower. And so this sort of intuitively obvious result encouraged us to take the next step. And then we tried to calculate the exposure to different levels of rainfall, again using provincial mean rainfall data to calculate a rainfall anomaly index. And then we tried to look at what possible impacts that might have. And we used detrended provincial rice paddy harvest to calculate a harvest anomaly index. And then to assess vulnerability overall, we took the rainfall harvest anomaly and divided it by the rainfall anomaly. And I apologize for the somewhat boring and esoteric methodological digression here. And then we did a very simple regression analysis, just to see if we could come up with some demographic, population, cultural, agricultural management variables that helped explain this. Okay, so those are my four case studies. I'd now like to try to summarize.
You still have about 5 minutes.
Perfect, thank you. I'd like to quickly summarize the contribution to vulnerability that these four case studies make. I think three themes run through the four case studies that help define vulnerability, and that in all four case studies across the board, ranging from our quantitative assessment of China to our qualitative assessment of Ireland and the Victorian famine, the people who were vulnerable had little access to alternative types of capital. In Ireland, this is illustrated nicely by another woodcut from the London newspaper at the time, showing a typical famine victim, a single mother with some children and no agricultural management, uh, uh, no sophisticated agricultural tools, very little in the way of land, going back over her field, probably for the third time, harvesting what few potatoes might have remained in the field. In the late Victorian famines, there was a transition leading up to the famine from traditional economies to part of colonial empires, and this meant poor people became laborers on large plantations. When crop failed, there were no alternatives. People did not have any alternative assets, alternative livelihood bundles in order to draw upon. In Ethiopia, the province worst hit by the famines and the droughts was the province of Wallo, where agriculture employs over 90%, suggesting there was no other alternative livelihood opportunities for people. And leading up to the famines, there had been a policy of villagization that had moved people off of traditional communities and onto Soviet-style agricultural communes. And this undermined traditional communities and the drought coping mechanisms that would have been in place in those traditional communities. And finally, in China, we discovered with a statistical analysis that areas with less rural labor had poor harvests in years with below average rainfall than areas with more rural labor, suggesting that the amount of rural labor was a significant contributor in allowing people to obtain high harvests despite bad rainfall. The second theme is that there are fragile agroecosystems at work. And we found evidence for this in the Irish, Ethiopian, and Victorian case studies, not the Chinese one. In Ireland, this photograph is of the potato fields on the west coast of Ireland. And what I draw your attention to, since it's somewhat dark, is that the fields are very, very small and tight packed together. And this was a function of this is an illustration of a very, very vulnerable landscape, a landscape where a pest would have no problem decimating huge areas. Population pressures, demographic changes, economic changes had changed this landscape or created this landscape over the previous 40 years. Early in the 1800s, this landscape would have been an extensive, diversified landscape. I can talk about the reasons why afterwards if you're interested. This is an illustration of what happened to the agroecosystem in the Victorian period. This is a tea plantation from India. And basically what had happened was the British government corporate interests established large plantations, cutting down forests and hiring people back. Again, this was an illustration of a very vulnerable landscape. In Ethiopia, I haven't been able to test this empirically, but there's enough literature that Ethiopia was especially vulnerable at that point because the cumulative effect of many years of drought had eroded ecosystem natural buffers. There was very little in the way of soil moisture or organic material left in the soils after the effect of many years of drought. The third and final common theme that runs through all four case studies, I think, is that there's nothing in the way of institutional safety nets. In Ireland, the rich and the powerful tended to evict people from their homes for failing to pay rent. It's a bit more complicated than that. There was some poor relief offered, but most famine victims' experience of formal institutions in their society was the bailiffs coming to throw them out of their farms. In the late Victorian famines, the British imperial government argued that famine relief would only worsen problems of overpopulation. This was sort of a Malthusian sort of approach. And Sir Evelyn Baring, the England's finance minister, when asked why England wasn't doing more to relieve the famine, said that any policy to mitigate the effects of famine would only serve but to enhance the evils resulting from overpopulation. Sort of illustrates to me that the English government wasn't really interested in providing strong institutional support to the victims. In Ethiopia, during the famines, the pro-Soviet junta hid news of the famine from the international community and only distributed food relief to political allies and forcibly moved people from their homes. And finally, in China, this is sort of interesting, areas with high urbanization rates are worse at maintaining harvests in bad rainfall years. And this suggests to me that agriculture may not be the focus of policy in China. I don't think I'm making a very controversial statement here. And maybe this accounts for one reason why some provinces in some years are worse at maintaining harvests. So to try to pull this together in the very last few minutes, I think we can return to my research design, and I think the three themes can fit onto this research framework. And if we're facing a drought or an environmental change event, I think the first question we need to ask is, are agroecosystems resilient? And if the answer to this question is yes, then the impact of the drought may be restricted to the harvest impacts. If the answer to the question is no, then we have to ask the question, do people have access to different forms of capital that would help them adapt? And this may result in economic impacts, but avert a catastrophe. If the answer to this question is no, then the third line of defense are, do institutions have a capacity to respond? And I think we can sort of define a vulnerable system as one that's sort of compressed on the x-axis, where a smaller drought triggers a bigger impact, versus a resilient system that might be compressed on the y-axis, where even a big drought is the impacts are relatively constrained. And I think we can do with these three variables something like what the landscape ecologists did with their three variables when they looked at why a forest burns down. And I think that we can sort of use these three variables to define a vulnerability space, where the robustness of the agri-ecosystem, the institutional capacity to respond to a crisis, and access to capital or alternative livelihood bundles provides a space that we can use to identify regions that are vulnerable. And if we see a region moving to the top right backhand corner of this space, or the red region, the number 8 in this diagram, then we may be identifying a region that smaller and smaller problems will have bigger and bigger impacts versus a movement to the front left bottom corner of this space, where you may be seeing a situation where an even bigger and bigger problem can be adapted to with relatively little problems. So that's basically what I wanted to say. I need to very quickly acknowledge the people at the Sustainability Research Institute, the Chinese National Academy of Science, and the University of Cambridge, who I've been working with. Chinese Meteorological Administration was great in providing access to data, and then funding for this project has come through and is ongoing with the UK's Natural Science and Environment Research Council and our Economic and Social Research Council. And that's who I am, if anybody wants to do any follow-up. Thank you.
Vous venez d'entendre Henri Le Ridon et Evan Fraser. Henri Le Ridon, premier intervenant, développait la relation entre population humaine et climat dans l'histoire. Evan Fraser, quant à lui, s'intéressait à la résistance des systèmes d'alimentation aux changements climatiques à venir. On marque une pause avant de retrouver le colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes, organisé par l'Académie des sciences et la Fondation Simone Echino del Duca en juillet 2007. À tout de suite. De la retransmission du colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes, dans cette deuxième partie, Christian Gaulier de l'Université de Toulouse 1 fait le point sur les efforts de prévention envers les événements extrêmes. Auparavant, débutons par les interventions conjointes de Denis Coeur et Michel Lang. Ils travaillent respectivement à Grenoble et Lyon sur l'analyse historique de documents anciens concernant les risques naturels. Ensemble, ils développent la thématique suivante, information historique et mémoire des inondations, les outils pour la prévention des risques naturels et l'aménagement du territoire. Les interventions de Denis Coeur et Michel Lang sont en français, celles de Christian Gaulier en anglais.
Tout d'abord, effectivement, le retour des crues extrêmes, les historiens et les géographes ont pu les constater sur l'ensemble du continent européen par une série de travaux maintenant depuis un peu plus d'une dizaine d'années, en Europe centrale notamment autour du professeur Brasdil, en Allemagne autour du professeur Gleiser, en Suisse, en Italie et aussi en Espagne. Ce que l'on ce que l'on a utilisé, ce sont avant tout des sources à la fois narratives pour la période médiévale et moderne, et puis à partir de la fin du XVIIIe siècle, des données plus quantitatives sur les hauteurs d'eau enregistrées le long des fleuves, et qui ont permis pour faire vite, d'obtenir au fond des synthèses sur le retour de ces événements. Et notamment, bon, ici c'est un exemple espagnol, on a pu montrer l'oscillation du retour de ces événements sur la période du dernier millénaire, avec des moments de concentration de ces crues extrêmes. Ici, donc, on est sur le nord de l'Espagne, on retrouve trois périodes qui sont au cours du petit âge glaciaire, bien, bien connues maintenant. Et bon, face à ces événements, il est vrai que on peut se poser la question de la manière dont les sociétés ont réagi, et bon, c'est un petit peu le sens de ma présentation aujourd'hui. Autre exemple, donc là il s'agit d'une étude menée sur l'Isère, on voit également apparaître dans ces séries des événements qui sont pointés ici, des regroupements, en tous les cas des phases chronologiques où on voit apparaître un certain nombre de d'événements extrêmes qui sont au moins aussi importants que ceux qu'on a pu connaître au cours des 10 dernières années. Bon, l'idée qu'il y a derrière tout ça, c'est qu'au fond, bon, la réponse que la société apporte face à ces retours d'événements est très variable d'une région à l'autre et des conditions socio-économiques à l'autre. Et il est très net que les premiers travaux menés par les historiens ont bien différencier ce qui ressort au fond des zones urbaines fortement, encadré au niveau technique et politique, des zones plus éloignées au fond du développement, en tous les cas d'un certain développement, que sont les zones de montagne par exemple. Et notamment au cours des 5 derniers siècles, l'élément important a été au niveau politique l'avènement, en tous les cas l'enracinement des États qui ont, permis en tous les cas un certain nombre de sociétés et de villes gérer au mieux ces phénomènes. Alors, je prendrai quelques exemples, sans parler évidemment des conditions scientifiques et techniques qui les ont accompagnées. Les cités fluviales, entre autres, ont subi ces événements au cours des 5 derniers siècles de manière très importante, aussi bien le long des grands fleuves que le long des cours d'eau plus restreints, et notamment la réponse essentielle dans un premier temps, jusque à la seconde moitié du XVIIIe siècle, a été avant tout une réponse en termes de travaux publics. Et ce sont les grands ouvrages qu'on a pu voir apparaître dans les villes autour déjà d'infrastructures comme les ponts, et puis des grands alignements d'endiguement, que ce soit sur le Rhin à partir de la seconde moitié du XVIIIe siècle ou dans la plaine du Pô dès le XVIIe siècle. Donc, la prévention, se résumait quasiment à la digue, à l'ouvrage. On peut le résumer ainsi, même si le trait est un peu forcé. Mais ce qui me semble, moi, le plus important, c'est-à-dire, c'est que, au fond, d'un point de vue culturel, on s'aperçoit que on a souvent tendance à opposer la modernité du XVIIIe siècle, les Lumières, avec une conception ancienne, religieuse, de la nature. Et ce dont on s'aperçoit en tous les cas pour ces grands événements-là, c'est que dès la fin du Moyen-Âge, on a, de la part des édiles locaux notamment, un très grand pragmatisme en matière de lutte. C'est-à-dire que d'un côté, effectivement, on croit que c'est la punition divine d'une certaine manière, mais d'un autre, on est très concrètement sur le terrain à mesurer avec les moyens du bord, si on peut dire, les impacts du retour de ces grandes crues, et on établit des ouvrages en conséquence. Et je crois que c'est un fait, historique très intéressant, c'est-à-dire que l'événement extrême sollicite la société jusqu'à des inventions nouvelles. On le voit par exemple dans l'ère alpine. Ce qui était très intéressant, c'est que là, c'est moins, le transit liquide que le transit d'alluvion qui a posé des soucis. Et du coup, on a imaginé des types de digues différentes, en empruntant notamment aux militaires les systèmes de glacis pour permettre de renforcer et de conforter des digues à l'origine militaire. Donc un encadrement renforcé des cours d'eau qui, au fond, vont participer à une certaine modernité de l'encadrement du territoire, notamment avec la genèse de nouveaux réseaux techniques. Je crois que la crue extrême va faire découvrir, notamment pour les ingénieurs en France, va faire découvrir, j'allais dire, l'importance de la définition spatiale de l'espace fluvial. Et on voit apparaître, dès la première moitié du XVIIIe siècle, notamment dans le corps des ponts et chaussées en France, une manière de représenter le cours d'eau qui va permettre de décrire de manière très précise, de plus en plus précise, l'extension extrême du cours d'eau, et du coup donner des manières à voir très problématisantes, très, très encadrantes et donc très opérationnelles de ce fleuve. Ça va se faire de manière, évidemment, avec un certain nombre d'étapes. Jusqu'au XIXe siècle, à imaginer, grâce aussi à la science hydraulique qui se développe, des systèmes de mesure et d'encadrement. Ce sont évidemment l'essence des services d'annonce des crues qui viendront simplement à la fin du XIXe siècle. Mais au fond, la pose de stations d'observation participe à cette structuration et à cet encadrement technique du cours d'eau. Il me semble que, si on pouvait résumer d'un point de vue très général cet encadrement au fond de l'espace fluvial, moi je vais dire que autant il y a eu des destructions, autant la réponse des collectivités face à ces retours participe de la modernisation des espaces urbains, et notamment tous les questionnements qu'ont posés pour les villes du XIXe siècle. La survenue de ces grands événements hydrauliques ont amené les ingénieurs et les architectes urbains à se poser la question de l'équilibre des réseaux d'assainissement et le fait de penser les réseaux. À Paris notamment, Belgrand, quand il réfléchit aux crues extrêmes, aux crues de la Seine, il pense en même temps à ces réseaux d'écoulement et à quel niveau il va caler ces réseaux d'écoulement. Et je vais dire, on retrouve aussi bien en Italie après les grandes crues de 1839 notamment, c'est ce type de réflexions qui sont très importantes. C'est-à-dire qu'on n'a pas une destruction pour une destruction, on a aussi derrière tout un engagement scientifique et technique pour encadrer ces événements. Je passerai très rapidement en fait sur la réponse plus politique et administrative en termes de secours cette fois aux populations. C'était moins mon parti aujourd'hui, mais il reste relativement faible par rapport aux dégâts en général. On passe du don royal à des systèmes de dégrèvement au XVIIIe siècle qui sont beaucoup plus au fond des aides ponctuelles. À une véritable aide, puisqu'en général, ça représente moins de 10% en fait des dégâts qui sont amortis, si on peut dire, par les secours. Les souscriptions ponctuelles ou plus générales intervenant seulement au XIXe siècle. Alors, bon, il s'agit ici simplement de survoler, de poser un certain nombre de questions. J'allais dire que cette histoire du rapport des sociétés avec la crue extrême est une histoire riche, mais qui est à peine entrouverte par la collectivité d'historiens. Et c'est vrai que ça pose la question à plus long terme de la vulnérabilité des systèmes socio-techniques. On l'a vu pour les villes, au fond, ces questions ont été relativement bien gérées parce qu'il y a une réponse à travers notamment la mobilisation des grands corps techniques que sont les ingénieurs, aussi bien en France qu'en Italie notamment. Mais le temps long de l'aménagement, lui, on l'apprécie mal par rapport à ces questions-là. Et aujourd'hui, ce sont des questions qui commencent à mobiliser les historiens. Alors, il y a aussi tout un versant qui est derrière, au fond, cette analyse, c'est le versant de la définition de ce qu'aujourd'hui on appelle l'aléa. Et c'est vrai que les sources documentaires que l'historien utilise par ailleurs pour comprendre les sociétés permettent également d'apporter pour l'hydrologue d'aujourd'hui un certain nombre d'éléments techniques, de descriptions. Donc c'est ce qu'on a essayé de mettre en œuvre avec les hydrologues du CEMAGREF. Et c'est mon collègue Michel Lang qui va vous présenter la démarche suivie. Merci.
Bien, donc je continue. En termes de réduction du risque d'inondation, on distingue habituellement trois grands volets. D'abord, des actions sur la prévision des crues pour essayer d'anticiper les phénomènes et prendre les mesures adéquates. Ensuite, des actions de prévention donc pour gérer l'aménagement du territoire en intégrant les phénomènes naturels. Et enfin, des mesures de protection, donc par le biais de barrages pour essayer de réduire les pointes de crue, et des protections locales à partir de digues pour empêcher l'eau d'atteindre des secteurs sensibles. Donc chacun de ces trois volets, on raisonne sur un aléa de référence. En prévision, on essaye de graduer les phénomènes à venir par rapport à des intensités de référence. En termes de prévention, je vais en parler maintenant, on établit des plans de zonage qui sont établis par rapport à un aléa de référence. Et en termes de protection, on va dimensionner des ouvrages également par rapport à un aléa de référence. Donc en fonction des enjeux, ce sera par exemple la crue décennale en réseau d'assainissement, ou ça pourra être la crue centennale, voire une crue beaucoup plus forte pour des ouvrages hydrauliques qui impliquent des enjeux en termes de vie humaine. Donc au niveau français, les plans de prévention du risque d'inondation résonnent sur la plus forte crue connue et bien documentée, et éventuellement la crue centennale si elle est plus forte. Donc cette définition pose plusieurs questions. En termes de crue historique, quelle crue retenir ? Donc est-ce qu'on raisonne simplement sur la crue la plus forte du XXe siècle ou on remonte plus loin ? Et si on remonte vraiment loin dans le passé, peut-on garantir que les hauteurs d'écoulement de cette crue ancienne restent représentatives des conditions d'écoulement actuelles ? Ensuite, en termes de crue centennale, c'est une approche probabiliste, donc qui comporte par essence un certain nombre d'incertitudes liées à l'échantillonnage, aux erreurs de mesure sur les débits et aux extrapolations qui sont faites à partir d'un modèle probabiliste. Donc on s'est attaché à développer un programme de recherche pluridisciplinaire sur les crues historiques avec trois grandes étapes. La première consiste à, donc c'est le travail de l'historien, à collecter les informations historiques sur les inondations, donc d'abord à faire un état général des sources disponibles, ensuite à faire une synthèse de ces informations dans trois historiques. Donc là on a défini une grille de lecture hydrologique puisqu'on va interpréter ces phénomènes anciens à des fins hydrologiques. Donc on bâtit un historique des producteurs de données qui va nous permettre de repérer les sources de données intéressantes. Un historique des méthodes et matériels de mesure pour avoir un regard critique sur les données anciennes. Et un historique sur les événements sur le bassin, donc événements en sens large, les crues évidemment, mais également les aménagements qui ont pu avoir lieu sur le bassin, sur la rivière, donc qui sont susceptibles d'avoir modifié les relations hauteur-débit, et aménagements sur le versant susceptibles d'avoir modifié la genèse des crues. La deuxième étape va consister à convertir les hauteurs des crues anciennes en débit, donc à partir d'une analyse hydraulique. Donc on regarde d'abord si la topographie de la rivière a évolué ou pas, s'il y a eu des incisions ou des exhaussements du fond du lit. Ensuite, on recherche des lignes d'eau, des informations sur les laisses de crues en différents endroits qui vont nous permettre de caler les modèles hydrauliques. Et enfin, donc on reconstitue les débits et on associe aux valeurs estimées une incertitude. Et le dernier volet consiste à faire une analyse probabiliste des crues, justement pour avoir une estimation de cet aléa de référence, donc un débit relié à une probabilité donnée, la crue décennale, la crue centennale ou plus. Donc on a regardé si l'échantillon sur lequel on raisonnait pouvait être considéré comme stationnaire ou pas. On a regardé quel était l'apport de la formation historique pour choisir tel ou tel modèle probabiliste. Et enfin, on a fait des études d'incertitude pour essayer d'estimer l'apport de la formation historique pour affiner l'estimation des crues extrêmes. Donc là, vous avez un tableau qui récapitule les travaux qu'on a pu mener sur un certain nombre de rivières dans l'Isère, et puis des crues Cévenol dans l'Ardèche, le Gard, l'Hérault et l'Aude. Donc grosso modo... on a quelques dizaines d'années d'observation de façon systématique, voire un siècle lorsqu'il y avait un service d'annonce des crues qui existait. Et donc le travail a permis de remonter beaucoup plus loin dans le passé, sur 2, 3, 4 siècles. Et donc il s'agit de projets qui ont été financés soit au niveau du département de l'Isère, de la région Rhône-Alpes, du ministère de l'Environnement ou un projet européen. Donc là, on voit un exemple sur un graphique de probabilité où en abscisse, on a la paire de retour, en ordonnée, le débit. Donc les croix représentent les observations disponibles sur les 50 dernières années. La courbe en pointillé représente un ajustement effectué à partir des données de débit uniquement. Et la courbe en rouge, c'est une méthode, la méthode du Gradex, qui est utilisée depuis une trentaine d'années pour la sécurité des grands ouvrages hydrauliques en France. Donc apparemment, cette méthode ici surestime les observations. Et ce qui est intéressant, c'est quand on rajoute les données historiques disponibles depuis 2-3 siècles, on s'aperçoit qu'en fait, cette méthode est tout à fait cohérente avec les crues extrêmes. Une deuxième approche qui a été pratiquée dans le cadre du projet européen SPHERE, consiste à s'intéresser aux dépôts de sédiments de crue. Donc en fait, en crue, la rivière charrie un nombre important de matériaux qui vont se redéposer dans les secteurs où les vitesses chutent. Donc il y a des zones privilégiées qui peuvent être les élargissements de la rivière avec des recirculations, les zones de confluence, les zones de débordement au dehors du lit mineur, et puis des grottes qui sont perchées plus ou moins haut par rapport au lit mineur. Donc là, il y a une étude qui a été faite sur le bassin de l'Ardèche en exploitant une particularité du site de Vallon-Pont-d'Arc. Donc on voit ici sur le graphique l'ancien méandre qui coulait à gauche et qui a été court-circuité il y a quelques milliers d'années, et la rivière a pris le raccourci, il y a une arche naturelle. Et donc ce qui est intéressant, c'est que pour une très grande crue, le méandre est situé une vingtaine de mètres au-dessus du lit mineur. Pour ces grandes crues exceptionnelles, l'eau peut reprendre, une partie de l'eau peut à nouveau s'écouler par le méandre. Et donc c'est arrivé notamment en 1890 et une autre crue au 19e siècle. Donc là, ce qui est intéressant, c'est que si on regarde, on cherche la trace de sédiments de crue dans le méandre, on aura un marqueur de toutes les crues les plus fortes qui ont pu avoir lieu dans le passé. Donc là, on voit un exemple de tranchée qui a été faite sur un point là où il y a une étoile dans le méandre, et donc qui consiste avec une analyse stratigraphique de séparer en différentes unités et à rechercher ensuite la trace de matériaux organiques. Donc on va dater les dépôts par carbone 14, ou s'il y a des grains de quartz, par la thermoluminescence, c'est-à-dire que le pouvoir réfléchissant du quartz diminue en fonction de du temps d'enfouissement. Et donc ça permet de dater, et donc après, on a une stratigraphie avec les différents niveaux et des dates. Donc les résultats qui ont été obtenus sur l'Ardèche ont montré une assez bonne cohérence entre les dates de crues obtenues par les sédiments et puis les crues qui étaient recensées dans les sources documentaires au 19e, 18e et 19e siècle. Alors ce type d'analyse peut être utilisé pour mettre en perspective une crue historique par rapport à une chronologie assez importante. Donc dans le cas de l'Ardèche, la crue de référence était la crue de 1890, qui était la plus forte depuis au moins 1644, et l'analyse paléo-hydrologique a montré qu'on n'avait trouvé aucune trace de crue supérieure à ce niveau-là depuis 2000 ans. Sur le Gard, en fait, c'est l'inverse. Il y a une crue très forte qui a eu lieu en 2002, et il y a une grotte qui est perchée au-dessus de ce niveau, et dans laquelle on a trouvé la trace de plusieurs crues, dont trois sur la période 1400-1800. Donc là, vous avez une image sur le Gard, les gorges du Gard, où on voit le niveau atteint par la crue, 14 mètres, et puis une grotte située 3 mètres au-dessus, où on a trouvé un certain nombre de dépôts à l'occasion de crues anciennes.
Il y a un certain nombre de problèmes qui se posent dans ces questions de mobilisation de l'information historique. Le premier, je veux dire, le plus important, c'est la masse d'informations qu'on est obligé de collecter et de rassembler. Et l'un des enjeux, notamment pour la définition des grands événements, c'est de pouvoir associer de multiples sources à l'échelle régionale. Et l'une des perspectives de valorisation, notamment en termes d'outils, c'est vraiment la constitution de bases de données qui est d'un apport essentiel pour analyser et reconstituer localement, puis régionalement, à partir de sources donc locales ou générales, ces événements-là, avec un ensemble de problèmes techniques qu'on connaît pour ce type d'outils, avec des applications très concrètes, à la fois pour ce qu'on vient d'évoquer de reconstitution d'événements extrêmes, mais aussi pour tout ce qui aujourd'hui tourne autour de la culture et de la mémoire du risque. Puisqu'au fond, à travers ces documents, c'est aussi la vie des hommes qui est décrite, bien souvent. Et donc, une sensibilisation directe à des événements passés et à leurs impacts peut être tirée de ces données-là. Avec éventuellement, donc, même sûrement, une association nécessaire avec tous les acteurs locaux, j'allais dire, producteurs et détenteurs de données, comme les scientifiques et les acteurs de la prévention. Bon, ici, c'est un exemple de base de données qui a été réalisée lors du projet Sphère, un outil un peu spécifique, puisqu'il s'agit d'un outil de recherche avant tout, qui associe à la fois l'approche spatiale, mais aussi temporelle de l'intégration des données, bon, avec des systèmes de requêtes un peu spécifiques. Bon, c'est un exemple parmi d'autres, j'allais dire, d'outils aujourd'hui qui peuvent être utilisés ou développés pour pouvoir intégrer ces données à l'échelle régionale, pour à la fois travailler sur le temps et en même temps sur les espaces.
Et dernier exemple de valorisation, la constitution de longues séries anciennes. Donc, on peut partir des données brutes et puis faire un certain nombre de critiques. D'abord, numériser les séries, les contrôler, faire des corrections et extraire des indices qui vont être ensuite exploités pour des analyses climatologiques. Donc là, les objectifs sont multiples. C'est d'avoir des longues séries qui nous donnent des informations sur la variabilité climatique passée, qui nous permettent de mettre en évidence des évolutions sur le climat présent, qui vont également permettre de disposer de données de calage et de validation des modèles climatiques sur la période récente. Et ces modèles, ensuite, on les utilise pour simuler les tendances futures. Et l'objectif, c'est également d'avoir une pérennité de ces longues séries, c'est-à-dire assurer que dans le futur, on va continuer à gérer les mesures sur ces stations et avoir un accès libre de ces séries à des fins de recherche. Donc c'est un travail qui est mené dans le cadre du comité consultatif des réseaux d'observation météorologique, donc qui regroupe les principaux producteurs météorologiques en France, donc placés sous l'égide de Météo France. Et donc il y a un groupe qui s'est constitué animé par Météo France et le CEMAGREF, et donc qui a pour objectif de constituer ces longues séries. Et donc on va commencer par travailler sur les critères de choix de ces séries de référence, avec des critères de qualité de données, de longueur de série, et on va réfléchir également sur le positionnement spatial de ces longues séries en France. Voilà. Je vous remercie.
Merci beaucoup. Donc le dernier exposé va être présenté par Christian Gaulier, qui est professeur d'économie à l'Université de Toulouse, où il dirige le laboratoire d'économie des ressources naturelles. Il est ingénieur en mathématiques appliquées et docteur en sciences économiques de l'Université de Louvain. Il a également écrit un livre qui s'intitule « The Economy of Risk and Time » et qui a été publié par MIT Press en 2001. Et le titre de sa présentation, c'est « Évaluation des efforts de prévention envers les événements extrêmes, Economic Evaluation of Preventive Efforts Towards Extreme Events ». S'il vous plaît.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here. I'm very glad to present a quick overview of the economic approach to the evaluation of preventive effort toward extreme events. So let me just say the following for presenting the objective of my quick presentation here. So we have all this evaluation of the impacts and of the risks that come from hydrology, climatologists, and other art sciences, and then eventually we need to make decision about what to do. I mean, we can have an agenda of possible action to reduce those risks. And the difficulty is that most often those actions are quite expensive, and so our resources are quite limited. So we need to determine among all the possible actions what are the most useful for the society, and therefore the question is how to rank or to prioritize the different actions in the face of those risks, keeping in mind that we have limited resources. So what I want to present is an illustration of the methodology, mainly from the very well-known Stern review for the reduction of greenhouse gases in relation with global warming. Okay, so let me just also mention that what is important to determine what is socially efficient to do in the face of this risk of global warming is that in fine, the people who will bear the cost and who will benefit from the reduction of the risk are you and I mean the citizens. And therefore, when we think about what is socially efficient to do in the face of those risks is to check the effect of those public action on the welfare of the people who bear the risk and pay the cost. So the standard methodology in economics to deal with this kind of problem is to use standard cost-benefit analysis. And in a world, cost-benefit analysis is what we do in everyday life, in our life. That is, we determine what to do with our money, with our incomes. We have many different possible will and desire to spend this money, and we compare the cost and the benefits of each possible decision, and we take the one that for which the benefits are the largest compared to the cost. But of course, when I say this, well, this is obvious. Everything is in the details. In particular, how do we measure cost and benefits? In particular, when those cost and benefits are uncertain, one dimension, and the other dimension is those cost and benefits are not immediate. They are scattered over for some of those risks in a very long time duration. That's particularly true, of course, for the case of global warming. There are many challenges in the cost-benefit analysis, and I just want to present a few of them today. Among those different challenges, there is the difficulty of taking into account non-monetary effects. I mean, and it's particularly problematic for global warming, where the consequence of global warming is not only financial. We will lose some of our financial assets, some of the buildings will disappear because of floods and things like that, but there are also many other impacts like loss of the biodiversity, increase in temperature will affect the value of environmental assets, and we need to take into account of that. And it's very difficult when we have many multidimensional impacts to determine what is optimal to do. In order to determine what is optimal, we need to have one scale and one unit of measurement. And usually we use money, we use euros. We could alternatively use the 1 hour of labor, that kind of thing. In economics, we use labor. We use money. So the question behind this valuation of non-monetary benefits is, for example, a difficult question is what the value of life. If one consequence of reducing the emission of greenhouse gases is we will reduce the risk of losing human life in 200 years from now, we need to think about what is the value of life. I mean, we as a society are ready to pay in money, in monetary terms, for saving life, not only today, but also in the future. For your information, in France, the value of life has been fixed to a little bit more than 1 million euros. In the US, it's around 3 million euros. Whether this is a good idea, whether we should use another value, well, it's a good question. Economists have been specializing, some of them, in the measure of this value of life. We, as individuals, we make decisions every day where we spend some money to reduce the risk of dying. And we can observe those behaviors and determine from those behaviors the value that people put on their own life. And from this, we can help the state to determine what is socially efficient to do in terms of the cost and what we should be ready to pay to save lives in our society. Another dimension I will spend most of my time on this is the question of how to take into account of the fact that cost and mostly benefits are uncertain. I mean, we are not sure about the consequence of the emission or the reduction of emission of greenhouse gases on the impact to the environment and to human activities, and the difficulties how to take into account of that. And eventually, in a very important question, it's very very clear in the Stern review, for example, there is a difficulty of how do we value the fact that most of the benefits of our effort today will be for the future generation. It's if you read the IPCC reports or the Stern review, you see that most of the cost of global warming will start to be borne in not less than 100 years from now. And so we have immediate costs, we have very distant benefits. Why? I mean, how do we value those benefits in terms of euro equivalent of today? That's an important question, and behind this question there is this problem of determining the discount rate, which is quite technical, but a very important question. I will spend 1 or 2 minutes on that in the last slide of my presentation. Okay, here is an example of what has been done by economists. This is the conclusion of a big conference that took place in 2004 in Copenhagen, and it gathered many well-known economists. Many of them were already Nobel Prizes, and others have been Nobel Prized since then. And what their objective was to organize and or to rank different possible action, public action that should be recommended to implement for in developed country and in developing countries. So we have limited amount of money to invest in those projects. So we cannot do all those projects all together. It would be a too large sacrifice for us. So we need to prioritize this. And the question is, among all those, and I have no time to spend on listing all those possible projects. You have projects on control of malaria and AIDS in developing countries, providing better water supplies in developing countries, and eventually you also have public investment prevention efforts for global warming. And you see that the outcome of this work by this top economists worldwide has been to put the lowest priority to climate climatic project. You see that the last three projects in this ranking are the three climatic project. Probably one of the reasons why the priority is so low for global warming is that, again, most of the benefits of reducing the risk will be for the generation living 200 years from now, and because those people use quite a large discount rate compared to the Stern review, very high cost today. Most of the benefits in the distant future, if you use a large discount rate, let me say 5%, those projects should not be implemented. So let me go to the Stern review. You all heard about the review that came out in October 2006. The main message of the Stern review is that we should be ready to pay as much as 10%, in fact between 5 and 20%, depending upon the calibration that we consider. But let me say, we should be ready to pay now and forever 10% of our total resources produced every year in the world to reduce or to eliminate, if possible, the consequence of global warming. That's because in the Stern review, it is estimated that the cost for society of the existence of this risk is equivalent in terms of welfare, of the welfare of the human beings living today and in the future on the Earth, is equivalent to an immediate and permanent reduction of the GDP per capita in the world by 10% again. In fact, the estimation by economists in interaction with the climatologists and the other art science dealing with global warming, the estimation of the impact to society, to in fact to the GDP per capita. For the next 200 years of the existence of global warming, you see this on this graph. You see, so that's the most important graph in the Stern Review, give you the loss, the percentage loss of GDP per capita for between 2050 and 2200 the percentage loss in the GDP per capita due to global warming. And the red line is for the expected loss. You see that the expected loss goes to almost 40% of GDP per capita in the year 2200. So that's quite large, but more impressive is the gray area. You see, the gray area is the set of interval of confidence at 90%. So you see, there is quite a large uncertainty about the effect of global warming on the loss of GDP per capita for the next 200 years. And so here, for example, for the year 2200, the percentage loss of GDP per capita is something. There is a 90% probability that the loss in GDP per capita will be between 3% and 37%. Okay, so you see the uncertainty is very large. And then the question is, how do we deal with this uncertainty? I mean, should we just take the red line as what we should use at the equivalent value on the effect of welfare, or should we take into account that not only there is an expected loss, but there is also a lot of volatility and variability in the consequence of global warming on consumption? Okay. Well, what we know is that people are risk averse, and people are risk averse. Human beings are risk averse. We should take into account not only the expected loss, but the uncertainty on the loss. In a way that we will do more to reduce those things that are more uncertain because people are more risk averse. So let me very quickly make a more detailed description of these ideas and how it is taken into account in the Stern Review. In the Stern Review, what we do in economics usually is to disentangle the different challenges that we face. I told you we face, when you look at this graph, you see that we face two challenges in order to determine what we should do today to face this risk in an efficient way for the intergenerational welfare. So there are two challenges. The first challenge is the fact that the benefits of our action today are mostly beneficial for those very distant generations. And so how should we take into account of this? I told you this is dealt by the discount rate. But there is another dimension, which is the risk dimension. So let me isolate the risk dimension. And let me raise the following question. Suppose that there is this year a risk of terrorist attack. Quite a hot topic these days. And we know the intensity of the consequence for the GDP per capita is unknown, taken into account all the consequences of the terrorist attack in terms of loss of human beings, of human life, in terms of loss of physical assets, and so on and so on. So what we know, suppose that there is a 90% probability interval of confidence that the loss of GDP will be between 3% and 37%, with the mean equaling 13.8%. Let me imagine that we have the possibility today, this morning, to make a decision to spend some of our resources in France to eliminate this threat of terrorist attack. What should we be ready to pay to eliminate this risk? Well, you see, this is equivalent. These numbers have been selected to calibrate the risk of global warming for the year 2200. But here, you see, I isolate the risk effect, considering only the one-shot event this year. Okay, so that's the question. I mean, should we be ready to pay exactly the mean, the expected loss, or should we be ready to pay more than the expected loss? Let me take a simpler question. Okay, those those numbers in the first example are difficult to maybe to integrate mentally. So let me go to a much more simple question where the risk is 50% chance. Okay, you take a coin, you draw it, and you look at whether it's head or tail, and whether it's head or tail, you get either an increase or a reduction of your wealth by 50%. Okay, a very big risk. So the question is, you don't like this risk. Usually most people are risk averse, as I told you. So what share of your wealth, what percentage of your wealth would you be ready to pay to eliminate this risk? Okay, so that's a typical question. Most often people are ready to pay something to eliminate this big risk, zero mean risk, as you see, of increasing or reducing your wealth by a certain percentage. So the economists use a model that has been heavily evaluated, criticized, using experiments in lab, looking at how people behave in the face of that kind of risk. And they provide this kind of analysis generated a standard model that we call the expected utility model that was proposed by Daniel Bernoulli in 1738. The Academy of Science of St. Petersburg. And the idea is that people are not interested in maximizing the expected wealth or the expected consumption, but rather the expected utility that they extract from this wealth. Wealth meaning consumption. And the idea is that an increase in wealth, indeed, when you get wealthier, you are usually happier, you extract more utility of this increased wealth, but the way you increase wealth is done in a decreasing fashion. That is, let me explain that with the graph. So when you make the link between consumption or wealth on the horizontal axis and utility on the vertical axis, which measure the welfare, okay, exposed welfare, the function of consumption, you see that indeed increase wealth means increase utility, but this is a concave relationship. That is, when you are very wealthy, increasing your wealth by one unit has a much smaller effect on your utility than when you are poor. And therefore, when you are facing this 50-50% probability to either losing or winning 50% of your wealth, you prefer to stay without the risk. So you are risk averse with this kind of preferences. So the standard model, this expected utility model, is we measure ex ante before knowing what will be the state of the world, what will be the real impact of global warming. We evaluate welfare of the future generation by evaluating the expected utility of their consumption. And if there is uncertainty on the consumption, we evaluate the utility of this consumption in each state of the world, and we take the expectation of that. So that's that kind of model for which we estimated a utility function imply that people are risk averse, and we can evaluate the impact of this risk aversion on their welfare, and therefore we can estimate how much we should ready to pay at the collective level to reduce those collective risks like global warming. Very quickly, because I'm running out of time, what we call the risk premium, okay, what people are ready to pay to eliminate the zero mean risk. This risk premium is a convex function of the size of the risk. That means that for very small risk, you are ready to pay almost nothing to eliminate the risk, but for very large risk, I mean, the risk premium is very large. So it's not important for society to deal with small risk. What is very important for society is to face with the potentially catastrophic event, and we should be ready to pay much more than proportionally lot of money for large scale risk than for small scale risk, and the Arrow-Pratt approximation tells us a lot about that. I have no time to spend on this now. So let me go to the stern review. Let me see how the stern review integrate that kind of thing. So indeed, in the stern review, they take into account of the fact that we don't know exactly the consequence of global warming, but they also integrate some kind of precautionary principle because they take into account of the risk aversion of the population, the risk aversion of the future generation. But the problem with the stern review is that the degree of assumed risk aversion is quite small. So let me go back to this example. Suppose that your wealth is under the risk of either being increased or decreased by 50% with equal probabilities. Okay, so on the I'm focusing here on the column on the right. So what should we be ready to pay to eliminate this risk? This is a question for yourself. Okay, suppose that you indeed face this risk today. In 5 minutes, I will draw a coin, and if, depending upon the outcome of the draw, you will either get an increase of your wealth by 50% or a reduction of your wealth by 50%. This is a problem. You don't like that. You would be much happier if you don't face this risk. So you are ready to pay something to insure against facing this risk. What should you be ready to pay to eliminate this risk? Well, in the stern review, it is assumed implicitly that the citizens are ready to pay as much as 13.4% of their wealth to eliminate this risk of losing or earning 50% of their wealth with equal probability, which is relatively small, I believe. I mean, most of the experiments that has been performed in economy in labs and most of the observation of real people behavior in the face of risk suggests that this number is quite small, and therefore the stern review underestimated the risk aversion and was not enough catastrophist in that sense. Okay, let me spend 2 minutes on the discount rate. The stern review has been heavily discussed among economists for the last 10 months or 8 months, in fact. Mainly, the discussion focused on the choice of the discount rate in the stern review. It was implicitly used a discount rate of 1.4% per year. Whereas, remember that in France, you may not be aware of this, but in France, the discount rate has been up to the year 2005, so 2 years ago, it was 8% per year. So this means that for 8% per year, the future doesn't matter, because when you discount at such a large discount rate, well, what happens in 30 years or 40 years from now, and not even speaking about 200 years from now, is completely irrelevant for the decision that was made in France for any public investment decision like in infrastructure, like environmental prevention of environmental risk, and so on and so on. So they use 8%, that means no sustainable development. You don't even think about what happens in 30 years from now. You focus on the first 20 years, basically. But now, there has been a change, partly due to the pressure of a group of economists in which I was one of the leaders there. We went down to 4%, and even the state now recommends in France, use discount rate of 2%. So we are not very far from the discount rate of 1% per person. Used by Stern. Remember that when you discount a value of, let me assume that we have in 2 years, 200 years from now, you face a loss of 1 million euros. Okay, what should we be ready to pay now to eliminate this sure loss of 1 million euros in 200 years from now? Well, if you use cost-benefit analysis with a discount rate of 8%, you should not spend more than 20 cents today to eliminate a sure loss of 1 million euros in 200 years from now. If you go down to a discount rate of 4%, you should be ready to pay as much as 400 euros. If you go down to 2%, you should be ready to pay 20,000 euros. So you see, going down, yes? Yes, no problem. Thank you very much. That's perfectly in line with my project here. So I will not say anything about why it's socially efficient to reduce the discount rate and to open the windows to let the future generation enter into the picture of the public decision, as for example for the global warming problem. So, but basically, we discount the future because we believe that the future generation will be wealthier than us. Okay, imagine that we, as for the last 200 years, we stay with a trend of 2% per year growth of the GDP per capita. So if you expect a growth of GDP per capita of 2% per year, those generations who will live in 200 years from now will be 50 times wealthier than us. Okay, and if those people are 50 times wealthier than us, the question is, why should we be ready to pay, to sacrifice our present for the benefits of future of people living in the future who will be so much wealthier than us? So that's why we use a positive discount rate. That's why we say 1 euro in 200 years from now is less as value for the society, which is smaller than 1 euro immediately for those people living today who are so poor compared to the people who will live in 200 years from now. Well, then there are other arguments, but basically this wealth effect is central. Okay, let me very quickly. I have two transparencies to finish. So let me very quickly mention a list of important elements that I did not talk about, that should be included in the analysis. Some have been included, some others still need some work by economists to be included in the standard cost-benefit analysis. So for example, in the standard review, there is an important element and an important impact, integration of the impact of the global warming on wealth inequality in the world. I mean, in the standard report, it is estimated that the one consequence of global warming is not only that the worldwide GDP per capita will be reduced by the global warming, but also the wealth inequality will be increased because those populations that are the most vulnerable to global warming are also the poorest. Okay, and therefore, we should take more care of global warming because of that. I mean, because fighting global warming is also a way to reduce wealth inequality in the world. Okay, and we attribute a value to fighting wealth inequality in the world. So that's one additional advantage and benefits of global warming. How is it included in the cost-benefit analysis? It's obviously a difficult question. I can answer to any question on this during the discussion. There is also an insurability problem. Also, the problem is today it's quite clear that we will not be able to organize an efficient risk sharing between different countries, between different regions around the world. And it's quite clear that some regions will be much more vulnerable than others. It would be good ex ante, given the fact that people are risk averse, future generations are risk averse, to organize some kind of risk sharing between the different populations. Some of them will be losers due to global warming, some others will be winners. Would be good, ex ante, under the veil of ignorance, before knowing who will be the winners and who will be the losers, to organize a risk sharing in the face of that. The fact that we cannot do that for political reasons, for many different reasons, implies that we should be more averse to those risks of global warming. We should do more to fight risks that we cannot diversify in our society. Those risks that can be diversified, that's no problem. For those risks that we cannot share in society in an efficient way, we should put more attention to those risks. Also, there is an important problem. Oh, yes, there is a problem. Okay, no problem. There is a difficulty in the STEM review, and it's quite an important one, which is the STEM review says we should do a lot to fight global warming. The problem is that they just consider two possible actions, either do something immediately or do nothing. Of course, there is a third strategy, which is to wait a little bit longer to get more information, scientific information, information from the historians, get reduce the uncertainty on the parameters due to the work of the scientists, art scientists and others in that field, and make a better decision under a reduced uncertainty. So there is a problem of having the option value to weight. Okay, how do we value the option value to weight? It's a difficult question. In particular, there is two kinds of irreversibility that we should take into account. Waiting is bad because if we wait too long, the action, the emitted greenhouse gases will be very hard and very costly to get back if we realize that those increased concentration of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere is very has a very large impact to society. So there is a lot of question related to this, and economists and people from finance spend a lot of their effort to explain what to do in the face of this learn to act or act to learn effect. Well, and to finish, there are other two kind of problems. The fact that we don't know the true probability distribution, again. The fact that we don't know the true probability distribution implies that maybe we should not only take into account of risk aversion, but also we should take into account of the fact that people are ambiguity averse. And that's my last slide. Let me just to illustrate this, what is the notion of what is the notion of ambiguity aversion and how important it is for global warming? Imagine two games. In the first game, in the two games you have an urn, and in this urn you have black and white balls, and the game is I will take at random a ball from the urn, and if it is the color on which you bet, you will get 100,000 euros. Okay. And there are two urns. In one urn, there is exactly 50 white balls and 50 black balls. And the question is, how much are you ready to pay to participate to this game? Okay. In this game, that's quite easy. There is a probability of 50% to get the price of 100,000 euros. So what are you ready to pay to participate? Well, keep that in mind. And then, and that's it's finished my illustration here, suppose that I remove this urn where there are exactly 50-50 white and black balls, and I replace it by another urn. There are also 100 balls, but I don't, and some are white, others are black. I don't tell you the proportion of white and black balls. And I tell you, okay, first, on which color do you want to bet? And most often, when I ask that kind of question to my student, I say, well, we are indifferent. Okay, if you are indifferent, that's likely that you believe that there are exactly 50 white and 50 black balls. Okay, so implicitly it means that your subjective probability distribution is 50-50, exactly as in the first game. And therefore, when I raise the second question, how much are you ready to pay to participate to this game where there is no announced proportion of white and black balls? Well, you should be ready to pay exactly the same amount of money than in the first game in which there are exactly 50-50 white and black balls. Okay, but when we observe what people actually do, well, they're ready to pay much less to participate to that game with ambiguous probabilities. And that is not taken into account of those modeling. In particular, it's not taken into account in the Stern Review, and in spite of the fact that in the global warming problem, there are still a lot of uncertainty, parametric uncertainty about the consequence of global warming on human activities, and that should be taken into account, and that implies that the Stern Review, in spite of the fact that it's quite catastrophist compared to the kind of IPCC report, probably we should be even more catastrophist than what we have in the Stern Review. Thank you very much. Sorry, I've been quite long.
Vous venez d'entendre Christian Gaulier de l'Université de Toulouse. Il faisait le point sur les efforts de prévention envers les événements extrêmes. Il était précédé par Denis Coeur et Michel Lang sur les outils pour la prévention des risques naturels et l'aménagement du territoire. Cette première retransmission du colloque de l'Académie des sciences, écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes, enregistrée en juillet 2007, se termine ici. Poursuivez votre écoute en téléchargeant les quatre autres émissions, retransmettant la suite des communications, le tout dans notre médiathèque. Elles sont consacrées au rapport entre événements climatiques extrêmes et évolution des espèces, ainsi que les réponses des systèmes écologiques. Et les deux dernières retransmissions sont consacrées au bilan actuel des connaissances et aux recommandations. recommandations pour se préparer aux prochaines crues, ouragans ou encore sécheresses. Merci de nous avoir suivis et à bientôt pour de nouvelles émissions.